Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Abington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's edition of the War Report. Before we get started into the program, over the last couple of weeks, some people have let me know that they've tried to call in and participate on the show, and for whatever reason, they were unable to. And I've taken this issue up with the network. And one of the things I want to make sure those who want to call in are doing, that you are calling the right number. Because if you go to our program page on VBS Radio, you'll see a lot of telephone numbers. The one that you want is the call in and listen number. That number allows you to continue to listen to the show via your cell phone, at the same time being able to participate live on the program. And that number is 888-627-6008. Let me repeat that number. It's 888-627-6008. There are several 888 numbers listed there for different purposes. There are numbers there for Station 1 programming, Station 2. We're Station 1 programming, by the way, for people to just call and listen only, and people to call and get customer service, on and on and on. So make sure you're calling in the right number. And if you are calling in and you still can't get through, let me know so that I can go back to network and figure out what's going on and get it corrected. All right, into the programming. One of the things that I thought I should mention, this show is Back to School Show Part 2. Last week, obviously, we had Back to School Show 1. Back to school, what does that mean? Well, it meant that teachers, students, parents, admin, school board are back at the job of education. You know what? But many of you had 6 weeks off, 8 weeks off, some maybe more. I doubt there were many who had less than, say, 6 weeks total vacation. You're off, but guess who was not off? The Waltons, the Gates, the Broads, the Alex, the Obama, the King, the Secretary of Education, the mayors, the governors, the entire war machine against us. They didn't take off while we were, quote, taking off on our vacation time. You say, well, okay, what does that mean? I'm just thinking. They didn't take off. They were continuing to work their agenda. They were continuing to put pieces in place to further their efforts to get from point A to point Z. They were putting money in place. They were backing candidates for your local government, for your state government, and, of course, for the presidential race. They were working full-time, overtime. Their war machine did not take off. Where was our resistance machine during the same summer vacation. And what has happened over the summer on the resistance side versus what has happened during this summer on the war machine side? Think about that. Okay, into our program. And today I'm going to try and talk about what I had intended to talk about last week, and that is getting into higher education or college or university students and what they're facing. It's something that, of course, is my area of expertise that we don't talk that much about here on the War Report. For the 2.5 years or so that we've been on air, it's 98% has been about pre-K to 12. So I thought it would be nice to give you some idea what's happening at the college level. And one of the first things that comes to mind is there has been a growing assault on students and faculty in the form of the war on student and academic freedom, student and professors' academic freedom. One of the things that distinguish the pre-K to 12 community from the academic community is that in the academic community, we've had this thing for decades, maybe even close to centuries here, called academic freedom. Administration, politicians, philanthropists, they couldn't put their hands on us in the sense of controlling what we teach, how we teach, and controlling the discipline, controlling the academic themselves. Students less so in terms of this academic freedom, but students had freedom as well that you don't have in the pre-K to 12. And so there has been, as I've mentioned and you're very aware of, university and college have not been exempt from this war. They have been targets, maybe not primary, but secondary targets. But now there is a little more emphasis on targeting higher education. And the one area that sticks out to me right now is there's been this growing war, as I said, on academic freedom, and particularly on free speech. Over the last 2 years, at least, if not 3 or 4, there has been efforts on the part of academic administrators, including not only department chairs, deans, vice presidents, presidents or chancellors of university, now even the Board of Regents, Board of Governors of whatever the structure is for a given university or set of universities, have gotten emboldened in that they are attacking academic freedom and particularly, as I said, freedom of speech. And the 2 or 3 examples that readily come to mind was one is out of Illinois. I think it was out of one of the Chicago State Universities out of Chicago, where a professor, a noted professor, had gotten a job offer to leave his school, come to this particular school in, I think, the Chicago area again, contract issued, the whole 9 yards. He then gives up his job at his home university, only to find out that his contract of future employment, is rescinded by, I think, was the university's president. And it was rescinded. First of all, of course, there were reasons given that were not the real reason, but it was eventually discovered that the board of governors, regents, and what have you, put pressure on the president to make that contract of employment null and void. The board of I'm going to call them board of regents. I don't know if they were they're governors or what have you. The board of regents, in turn, received a tremendous amount of pressure from the philanthropists who supported the school and politicians and the scholar didn't get the job. He sued, won in court. The president, who was behind all of this, lost her job. And here is why. Almost every example that I'm going to give you have one thing in common, and it's the Israeli-Palestinian connection here. This particular scholar that I was talking about had written some articles wherein he basically tried to lay out what was happening to the Palestinians at the hands of the Israelis. And people on the Israeli side didn't want this type of information or discussion to be coming out of anywhere. They exerted their influence on the board, which in turn its influence on the president, and voila, the guy's contract was rescinded. That was kind of, I almost want to say, unheard of. You know, teachers in public schools, pre-K to 12, they get crap like that all the time. They'll get an administrator, a principal, they'll get a vice principal, whomever, coming after them and rate them low, very low on the scale, and use that rating to say that they need to be, quote, re-educated almost, and or lose their jobs. That happens routinely now in the last, since, I guess, No Child Left Behind. But it didn't happen at the university. It didn't happen in the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, the 60s, you know, and I've said this many, many times. We had this thing called academic freedom. It was a canon that no one violated. But now that canon is being almost pushed aside. There was another incident in here. The next two incidents are both California-based incidents. One was at one of the universities of California. I can't even remember now where it was, at Davis, I think, where the students were protesting. And the president gave the go-ahead for campus police to use a form of violence to break up the protest. And that same president did some other things, again, the false narrative as to why and on and on and on, who was to blame, and et cetera. Turns out that president was in collusion, president lied, president eventually was forced to resign. The latest example is happening now here in California as the flagship, University of California at Berkeley. I just found out about this one the last few days, in that I don't know if it's unique to the UC system or what, but students, and particularly graduate students, can propose a particular kind of course that the students would teach. There is a vetting process. You have to get an advisor to say, to sign off on it. Then maybe a chair of the department that the course would belong in would sign off on it. And then someone else higher up would sign on it. But once it was approved, The course could be taught. It could be taught by the students themselves. And when the course was successfully completed, students who took this course could get academic credit towards their degree. This has been established over the years. Well, last week, a course that had gone through the vetting process and was being taught and into second week, first week, third week of this quarter, was instantly cut off, banned, kaput. It was gone. One of the administrators, I don't know if it got as far as the president or it was one of the assistant chancellors, vice chancellors, or what have you, pulled the plug instantly. This has never happened in the history of the existence of this program. Never. Maybe a course had been suspended for a week or so if there was an issue until that issue was worked out, and then the course was allowed to resume. Maybe there was meetings over the course while the course was still being taught, and then there were corrections maybe that needed to be made to keep the course going, but never banned. Well, it turns out, again, that the course was dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and it was dealing with it from the Palestinian perspective. There were people outside of the university, including elements of the, I would want to say, the Israeli government, their supporters here in the United States, who put pressure on the president, or maybe the pressure came through the details are still emerging because there have been 50 million different stories each day as to what happened and who was responsible. And they're trying to find a scenario, the administration is trying to find a scenario that would possibly stick on the wall. The rest of the crap hasn't been sticking. But the bottom line is that outside pressure led to this administrator just pulling the plug. Again, this is a blow to both academic and student freedom of speech and academic integrity. And this is happening over a wide range of colleges and universities. There are firms that have been hired here in the United States to present the Israeli-Palestinian co-conflict, although it's not a conflict because on one side is waging the conflict at this point, and to present that favorably. And just, I think it was just in the last few days also, it was revealed that a firm out of Philadelphia was hired to wage a propaganda campaign directly aimed at the black and brown communities, because these communities are beginning to show solidarity support for the Palestinians. And this is now invading our colleges and universities. I don't know if it's hit our pre-K to 12 institutions yet, but this is something that college students and teachers are coming back to this fall, and it's ominous. And I definitely believe that we need to be aware of this, and because it's not going to stop. The other thing that is happening that our students and professors are coming back to this fall is a little thing called student income loans. And you can look this up because there's a lot that I need to say, but it's so detailed that I decided that I will just try and give the highlights of this and direct you to Google, and you can find tons and tons and tons of articles on student income loans. If there is a bottom line to what I'm going to talk about, you can think of this as, one, the transfer of wealth to individuals while placing the risk of these loans squarely on the students slash the parents. Now, what is this student income loan? Let's go back a little bit. The federal government, as you, probably most of you, not maybe most of you, but depending on when you were in school, you got student loans. You got scholarships, you got grants, but you also end up having to get student loans. And especially in the beginning of the 2000s, and even more especially from 2007 on, when the states unilaterally, well, also the federal government too, federal government started cutting back on its expenditures for public education. Then states started cutting back on its expenditures for public education, and they call it austerity. We don't have the money because of the financial crisis, and now you, the student at the college level, and the parents, we're shifting the burden of providing college education from us to you. And we can't afford it anymore. It's a social program. They don't say this. It's a social program, a public good program that we're going to shift to you. You're going to have to pay more of what it costs to get a college education. We're going to first raise tuition. We're going to hit you with a shitload of fees, parking fees, student fees, you name it, fees. We're creating fees so that the end of the year, we've gotten X dollars from you individually and Y dollars from you collectively. And you, the student and parent, or student slash parent, are going to have to come up with this money. And what you do in most cases, you got student loans. Back in the 60s, when student loans first came about via the government guaranteed the lenders, the private lenders, repayment of the loans in case the students defaulted. So for the lenders, it was a win-win situation. Gradually, the government, not gradually, just based recently, I think it was 2010, the government sort of like pulled back guaranteeing student loans, and instead the government started loaning, making the loans direct loans from the government to students, sort of like taking the private sector out. Well, the private sector regrouped and said, well, wait a minute. There are other ways in which we can still be major players in all of this. A couple things are happening here simultaneously. As the government pulls back and stop guaranteeing if the student default, we will pay the default, we'll go after the students. There was Fannie Mae, Sallie Mae, which was a quasi-government but private organization that was heavily involved in the student loan process. But then, of course, there were the banks and other nonprofit agencies that provided loans as well. Everything changed here in 2010, and that the government, I said, they changed the rules of the game and how the game was going to be played. Wall Street and the financial industry came up with a new program, this thing that they call student income loans. In essence, what it is that I will give you a loan based upon what I perceive to be your future and the kind of job that you're going to get and the kind of income that you're going to earn, and hence you will be able to repay my loan. In other words, another way of putting it is that I'm going to invest in you. I'm going to either be like a partner or like a parent. I'm going to invest in you because I believe that you're going to be able to pay back this loan according to the terms that you've agreed to. And I'm doing this without any way of securing this loan from that I'm giving you. I won't be able to, you know, go in and sue you, go into court and get a judgment, because this loan, unlike the government program, where if you default, you can't file bankruptcy, you're stuck with this loan until you pay it off or till they forgive it for the rest of your life. And you know how it works. If your parents co-sign this loan, then the parents are responsible. If you die, the parents are still responsible. These are sort of like guarantees that made the student loans in the very beginning a win-win for the banks, financial institutions, because either way it went, they got their money. And then the government was coming after you to get what they bailed you out of, sort of thing. And by the way, you know, when the government came after you, if you didn't pay your student loan, you're about to go to jail. Not one person that was bailed out of the financial industry for the fraud that took place here has gone to jail. I don't think they've even been on trial. So just a little aside there. But anyway, under the student income loans, you have this new mechanism where I'm going to loan you money. It's going to be unsecured because I believe that you're going to make a great income and you are going to do the right thing. You're going to repay this loan. That is the narrative that people give for making these loans. But that's not the real deal here. And that's what I'm going to try and take us to. The student loan, income loan, really makes the student. And as the title of the show said, was an indentured servant. Now, how many of you know about slavery and the term indentured servitude? Quickly, when the colony, Virginia, was established in 1609, Thereafter, when people in England wanted to leave England and come to the colonies, of course, they didn't have the money to pay the freight. They were able to sign what was called an indentured servitude agreement, whereby someone would say, we'll pay your passage, but you have to agree that once you get to the colony, you then will enter into a work servitude relationship, and you will do so for X number of years under somewhat kind of like Y conditions. And if you complete the terms of this agreement at the end of your term of service, you will be released from this agreement. And in many cases, the white people, what this started with them, they got land, they got maybe a little money to help them become entrepreneurs and start their own sort of enterprise. This was indentured servitude. You were obligated under this contract to work for X doing Y service or ABC range of service and what have you. Some people say that in 1619, when the first, quote, 20 Africans were offloaded on the shores in Virginia, Jamestown, that they were indentured servants. Others say they were out-and-out slaves, and the rules of indentured servitude didn't apply to them. But basically, some of the Africans did end up in indentured servitude status, and when they completed their term of service, they were released, and, quote, they were free, and they were able to have land and et cetera. But this notion of indentured servitude was that we owned you until you meet the terms of our agreement, we own you. And if the terms are broadly stated, we own you in so many ways that you can't even begin to imagine. And you don't have any recourse here. These loans, these student income loans, when I get to towards the end of here, I think this will become, I think and I hope, a little more clear to everyone, and maybe you will begin to agree with me and others that it's a form of indentured servitude, these student income loans. But now here's some of the details about this program, in that they provide tuition in exchange for a percentage of your future income. And both for-profit and non-profit organizations are engaging in this new kind of student debt investment that's unsecured. And what we have here is that you have a situation where college students are facing, I won't say a lifetime, well, let me go ahead and finish this because I'm about to say I may be wrong in that statement, a lifetime of indentured servitude. Here's how the program kinds of work. Investors, they still want to have some type of guarantee, some type of way that to assure them that there's minimal risk involved in giving you, me, a loan. That if we give you $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000, you're going to repay this loan from your future earned income. and the interest and the fees and all the things associated with it. So, absent the ability to do this through law, how can we minimize our risk? And here's what makes these programs undesirable. First and foremost, what they tend to do is cherry pick the students who are, and this is important, who are majoring in those fields that everyone believes the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years are going to have growth potential and be in demand and have high income earning potentials, i.e. engineering, chemists, technology, now security, industry, and you see where we're going here. Business majors, marketing majors. These are the areas where if I loan you money and you're going to get your degree, get your training in one of these areas, there's a high probability that you're going to be able to earn money sufficiently enough to repay my loan and the interest. Now, what does that do? They immediately earmark the humanities, arts, some of the social science, and other areas as areas they won't make loans to if you're going to major in art. You're going to major in music. You're going to major in philosophy. Who in the hell is going to give you a job in philosophy? But for teachers, guess what? They don't loan you money either. Think about what I just said. You wanted to go into education as an undergraduate. You're not considered a prime candidate for me to loan money to. Now, that says a lot. And what I want you to realize is that they've already decided that, one, becoming a professional teacher, going through a four-year program, and in like California here, a fifth year for your credential, you're not going to make, it's not, say, the best prospect that, one, you're going to get a job, two, you're going to keep a job, three, you're going to earn enough money to be able to live and pay me my money back. You are a high risk that I don't want to take versus my low risk engineer, chemist, and on. Business, law enforcement, you name it. Security industry, you name it. So, what is that? What am I saying here? What's the implication of all this? Duh. How many schools, public schools now, no longer offer music, band? They don't offer English. Well, they offer English courses and math courses. They don't offer but the minimum of history. No government courses. Maybe they may offer economic courses, but your arts, your humanities, they're the first to go. Because, and this is an argument that I make, and I'm sure others will make too, there is the perception that if we're going to eliminate those at the college level, then we need to definitely eliminate them at the grade levels. And also, we don't want those kinds of majors really going into our colleges. There's a connection here. There's some dots here that you should be connecting in your own head here. So what does this further mean? Is that the grade levels, they're already preparing students for careers and or college that are desirable by the business, entrepreneurial, corporate entities. In other words, it is that group that is now changing the purpose of education, changing the structure and the processes of educating. That group that from as beginning of education, formal education time here in this country, who've always wanted a seat at the table to say that we want you to educate kids for future employment, who didn't get their way for 100+ years, who are now not only sitting at the table, they own the table, and they're saying that educating people on this broad spectrum of the arts, the sciences, the history, and on and on, is not what you will be doing and should be doing now and going forward. Educate people on math, English language, communication, and that's what we need. That's the remaking of education and its function now to remake humanity in the face and the eyes of what the business or the 1% says that education should be and what it should have been but wasn't. And the implications go further and further, and I will deal with that towards the end more. And, I'm getting close to running out of time. Let me step this up a little bit. Okay. Another thing that they do, they say, one, let's loan money to students who are attending, say, the Ivies, the private Ivies or the public Ivies. Because these are the students who came out of high school, they were the cream of the crop, they go to the best schools, they're going to get the training, they're going to be able to get the jobs, hence they'll be able to pay us back. So they further this divide between the 1% and the 99% by loaning money to those 99%ers who are at the 1% schools. They get the money along with the other 1% who maybe need a little helping hand here so that in the future you still have this great divide. You get the 1%ers who have the advantage already. You get the smart kids who can become minions of the 1% getting the loans. And they do another thing. For that group, they give them loans at a rate of interest and fees that are more favorable than they give to students coming from the 99% and from the public schools that are not part of the elite college university spectrum. What these latter two factors do, they help create and maintain the divide between the 1% and the 99%. They further the immoral distribution of wealth and income that is so out of whack now, even more so than it was in the 1920s. When the big crash took place at the end of the 1920s into the 30s, they're redoing that same great divide, and they're classifying people according to their vision, according to them, and they're taking a huge whack at democratic processes and democracy itself. You don't think about those areas when you're thinking about getting your college education and how you pay for it, but they are linked. Most definitely, they are linked. And further, let's talk about here the fact that they're pushing students into vocations. They're telling students that your desire to become an artist, a philosopher, or anything that is not an instrument that can be used to further our agenda, we're not interested in. Now, let me go back and maybe restate this for a moment. What I'm saying here is, when public schools at the pre-K to 12th grade drop out the arts and the humanities, the history, the philosophy, and on band, the music, and what have you, and say we're only going to teach the science, the math, the technology, the English, they are, in essence, saying, you're going to become a mathematician, you're going to become an English or communication person, you're going to become a chemist, you're going to become a soldier, you're going to become what have you. Because this is what we need, this is what we want. You don't have a choice. If you wanted to be a ballerina or whatever it was growing up, you're not going to get that education, that training in our public schools, and you're not going to get it at the university. Hence, you're not going to be able to get it and employed because you come out of our institutions with training and skills that would allow you to, quote, get employment in those areas that you want to do for the rest of your life. To me, that's huge. What, in essence, I'm trying to say, the vocationalization of higher education. And what that means is that the universities and our public schools are now making decisions as to what your vocation is going to be by what it offers and what it does not offer. In a sense, they're weaponizing our institutions to train people to be what they feel they need to maintain the class differences that is to their advantage. And all of this feeds right back into what we've been talking about for the 2.5 years, is the neoliberal privatization and corporate culture that makes up what I call the Machiavellian agenda. There is a link there, folks. There are dots there that can be connected. I said this is a very sort of like brief overview. You can go and look up, as I said, student income loan, and you can find a lot more than what I was able to give you in this very, very, very short time. But, and I think you need to do it. And obviously I think so, because I'm spending time trying to help you get started on it. But you need to do it. The other topic that I was going to talk about was, I'm going to do a series on digital learning, and it has people like Emily Talmadge, Dr. Warner McDermott, Christine Killer. Christine, I just went blank on your last name, Kirkleback, and others have been talking about proficiency, individualized competency, learning, and it all boils down to computer-based learning. I wanted to talk about this months ago, but kept putting it off because the last time I talked about the proficiency, competency, learning, and tied it to neoliberalism, I think I did my worst show ever. I understood what I wanted to say so clear in my mind and the importance of it that I rushed to try and share it with you. I felt that I blew the hell out of it, and as a result, I felt that I needed to come back and do it again. And I compare it to what I did from the very beginning of my show, show one. I knew that it was the neoliberal ideology that was driving everything that we have been experiencing for the last 30, 35 years. But it took me 18 months to bring the audience to a point where I thought I could then have a conversation about it. End up having multiple shows dealing with neoliberalism and what I call the Machiavellian agenda. I want to take that same approach to this series on digital learning. And what I want to do is invite some of the people who have been giving us warning after warning after warning, what it is, why it is, and its potential impact on all of us and our lives, the planet, going forward. People like, I said, Emily, Dr. McDermott, and Allison, and Christine, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on last names, and others who have been writing about this. I'd like to invite them to participate in that series. If not, I'll do it solo. But it's something that I think, folks, it's everything that I've been talking about and everything that I've been trying to prepare us for in terms of our awareness, our understanding, and our emotional engagement, and hopefully motivating us to individually or collectively take action to defend not only public education, but humanity and the planet. Because this digital learning is the key to the total remaking of humanity and the planet. It's the key to what I said some time ago when I talked about an existential level event, when I talked about basically humanity and the planet as we have known it is under threat of extinction. This is where I think all of this corporate, all this neoliberal agenda is heading to. My time is up. I wish I had 2 hours there because this is so much I wanted to say and didn't get to. But anyway, thanks for being here. And next week, I won't start the digital learning series, but it was coming in the next month. Have a good Sunday, everyone. And thank you.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.